Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. The speech you're about to listen to is recorded at DEF CON 4 at the Monte Carlo Casino and Resort, freshly built in 1996. Copyright, all right reserves, except permission is expressly granted for non-profit educational use. Now sit back and relax. If you have any questions, please contact me at dtangent@defcon.org or visit our website, www.defcon.org. Thank you, and kick back and relax.
Right, well, actually, it sounds as though an English accent goes over rather well here, so I'll maybe stick with that for a while. It's amazing how you can say fuck you in English and it sounds much better. I do want to make it clear, though, to the person who offered to sell me a forged US passport last night, I am actually a US citizen, have been since 1981. Contrary to popular belief, when you become a US citizen, you don't have to change the way you talk. It depends actually which state they induct you in. An interesting thing happens when you become an American citizen. You are asked to forswear all loyalty to foreign princes and potentates. And I thought it was a pretty interesting thing. I started to think about what a potentate might be. Actually, it seems to be a lot more fun to tell stories than go through a set of slides. Last year, if you were here, I had a PowerPoint presentation with embedded OLE WAV files and the whole bit, and it really bombed because the sound system and the video system was pretty minimal. This year, it's even more minimal, so I'm going to completely dispense with that. I've got some slides here, but I'll just read from them. And I thought maybe instead of talking about 101 things to do with an ex-hacker, I might talk about the history of train spotting. Anybody here heard of train spotting? Okay, you're probably going to hear the word in the next couple of weeks because there's a movie just came out called Train Spotting, and it's about heroin addicts in Edinburgh. It's not actually about train spotting, but I figured if you could go back from here and explain to people when the word train spotting comes up in conversation what train spotting actually is, you could score some points. And it does, in fact, relate to hacking. Train spotting is something that people used to do in England when there were steam trains. And I probably look it. I was old enough to remember that when most of the trains were steam. They were just beginning to bring in diesel trains. And so when we were kids, we would go down to the railway embankment, and we would take out a pen and paper, and we would write down the name or number of every steam locomotive that went by. Obviously, this is a very, very exciting thing to do. I can see from your faces, this like makes a whole lot of sense, right? But if you think about it, the steam trains were the infrastructure of the time. They were part of the industrial fabric of our society, and we were really, really interested in them. This is back before the information age. We wanted to see these trains, and you'd go down there and you'd look at a few, and then you'd realize if you wrote down the name or the number, you could tell whether you'd seen that one before. And then it got to be a thing, who could see the most? And in fact, they started to publish books with all the names and numbers of all the steam trains, all the steam locomotives, and you would get the book and you would underline and write off the names as you saw them, going for this goal. And I don't think I ever met anybody who did it, this goal of seeing all of them. And I did this for several years, and then we decided if you sat at a railway embankment in a specific place, there was a limit to the number of steam trains you were going to see come by this place, because they were regionalized, there were regional railway companies and so on. So then we realized if you traveled around, this would be good. So there we were, about 11 or 12, catching trains to all parts of the country to go and see other locomotives. And then we figured that instead of standing by the side of a railway station, if you went to the sheds where they kept them, you could see a whole bunch at once. So we would go to a place where we knew, and you could find this out from talking to people and so on, where they stored the locomotives. And then the idea was to go to this place and get inside the shed and write down all the numbers of all the trains that were in there. And this was railway property, which has always been protected in Britain. There's always been a fence around every piece of railway property. And to get into the shed to see all the locomotives required that you go onto private property and you trespass. And we found that when we did that, some of the managers of the sheds were like, cool with this. This was, well, okay boys, come on in, you know, have a look around, don't touch anything, but you can take a look at these. And some were really cool, they would let you actually get on the trains and so on. Others did not think this was cool at all. If they saw you, they would chase you. And I thought this tied in rather nicely to this story. You would have people chasing you and say, either get out or stay there while I get your name, and so on. Not phone number, because back in those days, we British people didn't have telephones. And I think you can probably see the analogy there, right? This was before, really, there were many computers out there. This was in the early 60s. This was kind of a proto-hacking. Maybe in 100 years from now, we write the history of this, we'll see that people who went train spotting were actually proto-hackers. They were going out there trying to find the technology. They were prepared to trespass, perhaps commit illegal acts in a non-damaging way to fulfill their goal of acquiring more information. So eventually we stopped doing that, and there were several reasons. In 1969, the Irish Republican Army decided to declare war, and one of the ways they did that was put bombs on trains. And so the people who used to chase you out of the railway sheds got a bit more enthusiastic about it, and the penalties became quite severe. One of the things that happened when the IRA started bombing mainland Britain in the early 70s, which again relates exactly to what's happening in America today, is that civil liberties, which we British never really had a whole lot of anyway, kind of went down the tubes. And they introduced the Terrorism Act, which means that you can be picked up, held for 72 hours without any reason, without anybody being told, and without them ever telling you what you were being held for. Okay, now Britain is still supposed to be a civilized country, part of the membership of the family of nations and so on, but that's the law today in the land of Britain, is that you can be held for 72 hours with no explanation given to you, no explanation given to anybody. The police aren't required to inform anybody that they've got you. And every so often you hear stories of little old ladies emerging from police stations in the middle of the night, and that's what happened to them. They were mistaken for a bomber or something like that. Okay, so 101 things to do with the next hacker came from the dialogue, actually, which developed last time. I found it very instructive to come to the last DEF CON and talk to people about why some people thought hacking sucked, why the people who did it didn't think it sucked. And coming out of that, and I'm really going to keep this fairly short because there's some really useful information coming up from other people about actual code and computers and things like that. One of the things that came out of that was a new understanding on my part, or a better understanding of the hacking community. And that led in some ways to what happened at InfoWarCon in September of last year, where we did have something called the Great Hacker Debate, which pitted people who were very polarized in their opinions. Last year people talked about someone that I work with called Mish Kibay, who actually said in print at one point that criminal hackers were amoral, sociopathic scum. And we pitted him against Robert Steele, who many of you know considers hackers to be a national asset. And we had a very interesting debate. It was very instructive. Eric and Stratton, a number of people were there. And two things came out of that debate. Apart from the fact that our organization did disagree with Don Parker, and we went ahead, despite the threat of boycott and all sorts of recrimination, we went ahead and we said, look, this is important to do, to get this out in the open and talk about it. The two things that came out of it were that, first of all, the educational institutions in this country are probably not doing as much as they could to meet the challenge of people who have a lot of technological curiosity. I have a teenage daughter, and I can certainly tell you that her high school falls way short in terms of providing a technological challenge to students that keeps them interested and challenged in their efforts to learn about technology, to the point where they don't have to go off and use somebody else's computers to learn about things, whether or without their permission. The other thing that came out of this was that, okay, there are a lot of people who have done something called hacking. Obviously, we define it lots of different ways, but there are people who have done hacking who have acquired skills and knowledge which is very valuable. And are we going to be hardline about this and say, okay, because you at some point had unauthorized access somewhere, you will never again hold up your head in polite society, and you won't get a job, and you've ruined your life forever. And it seemed to a lot of us that this would be not the right way to go. That in most aspects of our society, if you do something wrong and you are caught and you pay the price, you do the time, you are allowed a second chance. We seem to be taking that away in some areas as we crack down on these various things that people get excited about from time to time. But basically, as a principle in our society, yes, you do the time, you are allowed a second chance, and it should be put behind you. So I got to thinking about, okay, what sort of process would that involve? If you had been hacking and you acquired this knowledge and then you wanted to put this to work, you decided, okay, I really would actually like to have a job working with computers. How am I going to apply for a job if I've got a record for hacking? Or how am I going to answer the question in the interview if somebody said, have you ever gone into somebody else's computer system without their permission? What are you going to say when somebody says that? And I don't have a sort of set of pre-printed answers to this, but I think it's a process that we are exploring, and I wanted to think of some of the ways that this might happen. And I also wanted to talk about some of the things that you could do if you decided to give up the illegal side of things and go straight. I spent the last 12 months traveling around the country talking to people about their security needs, their information security problems, and I can tell you two words: skills shortage. Okay, there is a huge shortfall in terms of people who understand networks, who know what people who know how to spell TCP/IP let alone know what it does. There's a big problem there, because if you take a look at the internet, there are 300,000 COM names registered, COM domain names. Every company is going to have 1, 2, 3, 10, 20 intranets now. So the vast explosion in web activity and intranet activity is soaking up all the people who know anything about networking. So certainly the time is right, if you have skills in these areas, to put those to paid employment. And yesterday we had a good talk about working for yourself. I spent 8 years working for myself. I liked it. I thought I was a good boss. I didn't always pay myself that well, but I now have a job where I get a regular paycheck, but actually it's a very enjoyable job. I have a whole bunch of computers to play with, and like I said, I travel around and talk to people about computers, and I like computers, so that's fine by me. I get to live in Florida, which is nice too. So there are things to do out there, and if you don't want to get a job working hands-on with computers, or you're not quite sure what you want to do yet, you don't want to make a commitment to a company or a career, think about writing about computers. You can make a very nice living writing articles for magazines, articles which actually have useful information in them. You know, there's a huge shortage of that. A lot of the magazines out there are full of the same old thing recycled without a lot of hard information. But there are magazines, and how many people have heard of Database Advisor magazine? The group called the Advisor Publications are starting to do some books now on networking and the internet that do have some serious stuff in. They want people who know stuff like Java, stuff like TCP/IP to write articles for them. And so you can do that. And quite frankly, if you get a commission to write an article for a magazine, then they're not really going to ask you where you got that information from. But what you are going to need to be able to do is deal with people professionally. And I'm not going to get into the debate we had earlier about do you need a college degree to do this. I think that's kind of a moot point, really. Personally, I went to university. The reason I went there when there was the Beatles. The Beatles got into the Maharishi, And I went to see the Maharishi, and he was talking about some very interesting stuff, but I found out that he wanted to charge you for this mantra that he was going to give you, that would give you all sorts of mind-expanding experiences. And I don't know, this didn't quite strike me as quite right, but there were people who were exploring Oriental religions, and I thought, well, you know, I'll go somewhere where they really know about that. And I went to university to study that, and I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do for a job afterwards. I went to study something I was interested in, and I think actually that's still the best reason to go to university, is to study something you're interested in. What I did learn at university, and I don't know if they all teach that today, but I learned how to learn. And it's amazing these days how the skills that you develop wandering around a library all those years ago come back. When you have to find things on the web, you find things on the net. What you need today, above all, is the ability to learn new things. And we're never ever, all any of us, going to know everything there is to know about computers. The skill you need is the ability to learn new things and acquire new information as it comes along. Another good skill is to be able to explain that in plain English to other people. That becomes a very valuable skill as well. So what sort of process could there be if you decide you want to go straight, you want to get a job working with security, say? There is something that is perhaps promising in this area. I don't know yet. Something called a Certified Information Systems Security Professional. And it's an examination. It's put on by a non-profit organization that you take, and if you pass it, and if you fill several other requirements, you can become a Certified Information Systems Security Professional, which is supposed to mean that you know something about this. It's some sort of validation, and I think we're going to see this in the information security area. For a long, long time, the professionals in this area have been people who've acquired information from lots of different ways. There's no standard career track to be a security professional. And so you've got a whole range of people out there, some from the military, some from law enforcement, some from academic sphere. People have acquired skills in this area from all different directions. And so there's a need for a standard test to at least establish a common core of knowledge and say, okay, these are the basic things you know to say that you do know about the subject. And if you want to look this up, go into Alta Vista and do a search on CISSP, and there's a site at the University of Toronto that's got information about what this is. Now, this is something which is just emerging. It's been running for about 3 years now. They do 2 or 3 examinations a year around the country. There are other requirements, though, one of which may disappear in the future, but at the moment you're required to have spent some time in the business, that is, having a professional job relating to security before you take the test. And the idea of this was that we've got to start somewhere with this. This isn't something that you can take straight out of a college course or so on. This is something you've got to have some experience to do. When I took the test, I found that a lot of the questions were still slightly behind the wave or behind the curve. There wasn't enough internet stuff, there was not enough actually LAN stuff in there. It's actually very difficult to develop a test in this area, a fair test of people's knowledge. It was still fairly DOD and sort of big system oriented. So it's not a perfect system. But it's something that's emerging, and if people get involved in it, they have the opportunity to shape it. So there are 3 requirements for this thing. One is that you're in the business and you've held down a job in it. 2 is that you can pass this test. 3 is that you subscribe to a code of ethics. And I decided not to bring this thing along and go over it point by point, but if you go to the site at the University of Toronto, you can read what it is. And it's actually fairly straightforward. What it's basically saying is that you're going to behave responsibly with the knowledge that you have. And let's say you were going to go down that road and you wanted to be a professional employed in the field, and you had a job running a network, you passed the test, which I think most people in this room could do if they studied for it, for sure they could pass this test. The third thing then you got to do is sign up for a code of ethics, and that's when you have to start making a decision about your behavior in the past and in the future. And I think what we see now, different from a year ago in the profession, is a different attitude to past behavior. I think people are prepared to overlook more than they did. One of the reasons that's driving this is the need for people. So you can go down that road, and if you can subscribe to that code of ethics, then you can make that transition. And I think what that code of ethics is, if you're looking at specifically that examination, that's one code of ethics. If you go to work for a company, they've probably got another code of ethics. And one of the things that I found out when I came last year was that hackers aren't amoral. I don't know about a sociopathic scumbag. It was a pretty interesting activity last night. The thing that I found out last year was that hackers are not amoral. I think if you're amoral, it means you haven't thought about morals. Most of the people I talked to last year and in the 12 months since are people who have done a lot of thinking about morals, a lot of thinking about ethics. They've thought about what they're doing. They've maybe come to a different conclusion than other people, but they have, relative, I would say, to the mean in society, have done more thinking about their motivation and why they do the things they do. And that puts you in a good position to deal with a decision you may have to face at some point, which is, can I subscribe to a code of behavior, which is maybe different from the code of behavior I followed in the past? And that's a decision you have to make in the specific circumstances when you come to perhaps make that transition. So I'm gonna end it there. I'll take any questions about train spotting that you have. Otherwise, I'll yield the stage to some technical discussions coming up now. So. Yes, sir. Oh man, you know, this really got me thinking about this, and I mean, it was thousands. I spent several summers. There was this cool thing they had, a rail pass that you could buy, and it was cheap, and you could travel all over the country. And I think if my mother knew what I was doing, she would have had a heart attack, which maybe some of us can relate to. Yes, sir. Well, that's an interesting question. The people, and I think this is why this is so good. And if you're looking for a thesis subject that would really impress a lot of academic people, you could do, you know, the relationship between train spotting in the early 60s in Britain and hacking in the 90s. You know, I mean, this is, academic people would love this. All these parallels. The question this gentleman had was, you know, were we interested in the technology of the trains? And some were and some weren't. You know, some people were in it for the aesthetics, you know, the that stuff, you know, and the fact they looked cool. Some were in it for the technology, yeah. Unfortunately, the steam trains were at that point, when I got into it, they were on the way out. So they were being replaced by diesel electrics and overhead electrified stuff, which, you know, personally, I thought aesthetically was really boring. I mean, the TGV in France is great, but boom, you know, that's it. There were also some who were into collecting bits of stuff. I don't know what happened to the phone sign from here, but there were people, friends of mine, who had, you know, bedrooms full of signs from railway stations and so on. And in fact, one of them actually went legit, and he now writes books about trains, and he still has a bedroom full of these signs. So. Okay, any other questions? I'm going to be around the rest of the day, so if you want to talk to me, I'll be around. I think I've finished so far ahead of schedule that Jeff is like, is Jeff coming back to introduce the next person? No, okay. You are, okay. Well, we have another, you'll probably have noticed as I've gone along, do you think my English accent has kind of changed while I've been talking to you? Yeah. It's become really kind of American now. It sort of floats around. We've got one more question here. Yes. Yeah. What's the average entrance fee to get to an NTSA sponsor? It's a lot more than $40. And I suppose I'll drop being polite in English. Do you have a problem with that? No. To be quite honest, this is a lot more fun than most of the ones that we put on. I mean, we put on conferences and we charge money for people to come. They're usually businesses that are paying it. We have had discussions about a student rate and well, I mean, to keep on putting on conferences, we've got to make money. It takes a lot of money to promote a conference, to get enough people there, to create critical mass. Although there's a lot of interest in information security at the moment, it still takes a lot of work to get out the information. And besides that, I'm not quite sure how GetCon manages on what they charge. And I'd be prepared to pay more. It was so much fun. Oh, yeah. Oh, my boss would love that. I forgot to do that. In September 5th and 6th, I believe it is, in D.C., it's actually in Crystal City, which is across the river in Arlington, is InfoWarCon. InfoWarCon is something which NCSA puts the administrative side on, WIN puts the program together, and that seems to work fairly well. Again, we charge money for that to cover the cost of administering it. The end of September, there is an Internet and Firewalls conference out in San Jose that is going to include web security, which will be quite interesting, I think. So,
where in the city
do you want to the InfoWarCon is at the Gateway Marriott in Crystal City, which is Arlington, Virginia. Yeah. If you go www.ncsa.com, just about everything we do is documented on there. Okay, so I will switch back to the English accent to hand over to the compere, who will introduce the next party. Thank you very much.